It's Central Time. I'm Jay Carlisle Larson in for Rob Ferret. He'll be back on Monday. You're with us on the Ideas Network. Coming up, it's Food Friday, and on this week's installment, we're talking about salt. We might take it for granted, but it can make or break a dish. We learn about the different kinds of salt and how we can properly use it. That's coming up next on Food Friday. First, former President Donald Trump has maintained that the 2020 election should have been a victory for him and his campaign. In particular, the former president has pointed to what he and his supporters claim is widespread voter fraud for his loss to now President Joe Biden. These claims have been proven to be incorrect, so they've been debunked by numerous organizations, including organizations like the Brennan Center for Justice. But the idea of widespread voter fraud did not originate with President Trump or his campaign. It can actually be traced back to a Texas businessman who spent years looking for GOP candidates who lost elections to take up the cause. Our next guest was part of a team who traced the push to use voter fraud as a way to challenge elections from what could be called the political fringe to the political mainstream, and how it has had repercussions over the past several months. You can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. What has been your takeaway from the 2020 election to today? What do you think about voter fraud claims? What questions do you have about these widespread voter fraud claims, though now debunked and have been debunked? Why do you think they became so prolific? Call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email us at ideas@wpr.org. Emma Brown is an investigative reporter at The Washington Post. Emma, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you for having me.
So before we get started, we should go pretty far back. So can you set the scene for us to tell us exactly who Russell Ramsland Jr. is?
Absolutely. He is a Texas Republican businessman, an oil. His family has a history in oil in Texas. He is a sort of Tea Party activist. He ran for Congress to the right of Pete Sessions in 2016 and lost in the Republican primary there. But the reason we became interested in Russell Ramsland, I don't know if your listeners remember, there was a press conference at the RNC, the Republican National Committee, with Rudy Giuliani and Sidney Powell in November 19th. Of right after the election. And it was a really wild kind of press conference. I mean, Rudy Giuliani was sweating. There was like hair dye running down his face. And he and Sidney Powell, they were saying things that just sounded so outlandish to many people who are listening. We've never heard this before, this idea that Venezuelan machines were running our elections and that the machines themselves had algorithms in them that were flipping votes and so on. And what we became interested in Russell Ramsland because some of these claims that seemed so new about voting machines being corrupted or somehow hacked that seemed new in 2020 had we found he had been, you know, saying and repeating for a couple of years before the election, you know, and giving these briefings in a office that was basically a converted airplane hangar next to an airstrip. Outside Dallas, where he had a security firm called Allied Security Operations Group, you know, briefing Republican activists and politicians, sometimes members of Congress. He spoke, you know, in the years before the election to Sidney Powell herself and Congressman Louie Gohmert from Texas. Anyway, he was spreading this message early, much earlier than it became known to sort of most of America.
Now, there is another player kind of behind the scenes, a woman named Laura Pressley. Can you take us back to her and her involvement since we're getting some historical basis for all of this?
Sure. Laura Pressley is an activist in Texas. She ran for Austin City Council years ago. She lost, and she became convinced that she lost because of either fraudulent or, you know, messed up machines, voting machines. These are machines, they've pretty much been phased out around the country now, but they were a kind of machines called DREs that don't print a paper record when you vote. And so it's very, you know, they've been sort of flagged by security specialist as very problematic for that reason. And that was the kind of machine used in her election. And so she started a sort of a effort to get to the bottom of what she felt was this problem in her election. And she obtained audit logs from elections in Texas. Audit logs are they're sort of a record of everything that the central tabulating machine does in an election. And she saw what she thought was very suspicious stuff in that election and brought a lawsuit. Her claims were not upheld in court, but she eventually met up with Russell Ramblin and told him about what she thought she had seen in these audit logs. And those became part of his central case that there was something wrong with the machines that we're all voting on.
And we are talking to Emma Brown right now. She's an investigative reporter for The Washington Post, and she and her team recently took a deep dive into the origins of what are now debunked claims of widespread election fraud, specifically in the 2020 election, where former President Donald Trump lost to now President Joe Biden. And, you know, a few minutes ago, you were talking about this meeting that happened at an airplane hangar where Ramsland was there. He spoke with, other Republican operatives or people big in the party. What happened at that meeting?
Yeah, so he and Presley, they wanted to find a Republican candidate from after the 2018 midterms. They wanted to find a Republican candidate who would who had lost their race and would challenge their race in order to sort of get more information about what had happened with the machines, get more information about the machines, more data. And they pitched a couple of candidates, among them Don Huffines, who's now running for governor of Texas, who had lost his seat in the legislature, and Pete Sessions, a congressman who had also lost. And neither of them took action on the basis of these claims. Neither of them ended up challenging their losses.
And do we have a sense as to why these candidates in particular didn't buy into it? Do we have a sense about that at all?
I think what we can say about that is it's not necessarily that they didn't believe that there was something wrong, but I think they perhaps didn't believe that they could prevail and sort of make a successful case in overturning the results of their particular elections. So, I think that's about the extent of what we know.
And can you talk about allied security operations, because that plays a role in all of this too?
Yeah, that's the name of Russ Ramblin's firm in Texas, and they this firm started. So there were these efforts before the election to kind of spread this message about hackable and hacked voting machines. And then after the 2020 election, Allied Security Operations Group, or ASOG, started popping up kind of all over the place in these efforts to challenge the election results. Russell Ramblin, as an executive of the firm, was submitting affidavits in Sidney Powell's lawsuits. Others who are affiliated with the firm were testifying for Rudy Giuliani at each of his meetings around the country in swing states, trying to convince legislators to appoint different electors or investigate further. So the firm became sort of ubiquitous is too strong a word, but they were popping up in a lot of important places in spreading the message after the election as well.
Now, we have this basis, and eventually they found, their candidate. They couldn't convince other candidates to take up this charge, but they were able to make inroads with the Trump campaign. And you talked a little bit about that, these meetings with other allies like Rudy Giuliani. How did these paths start crossing? And in your investigation, did you see that the path to what we later heard was kind of already set?
Yeah, I think what's pretty, what you said at the beginning of your question is very true. They these claims were really on the fringe, and until the 2020 election, when President Trump, just to be clear, he never met Russell Ramsland, but he met people and was close to people who had been talking with Ramsland, right? Like Sidney Powell, Louie Gohmert, Rudy Giuliani. And so, this idea about hacked voting machines that had been fringe before, Trump latched onto and started tweeting about, and many people started to believe it.
We are talking with Washington Post investigative reporter Emma Brown right now. She's with us to talk about how allegations of widespread voter fraud gained traction in the 2020 election. And we want to hear what you think at 800-642-1234. What have been some of your takeaways from how voter fraud claims became widespread? How would you like to see elections work moving forward? Call in now. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can tweet us at Central Time WPR, and we will pick up this conversation in just a moment here on Central Time. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Jay Carlisle Larson. Right now, we're picking up our talk with Washington Post investigative reporter Emma Brown. She recently worked on a piece that followed how election fraud moved from an airplane hangar in Texas to a political main stage. Some folks say that it's just been debunked. Others go so far as to say that it is a myth. There's a lot of language there. But we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. What questions do you have about this issue? What else do you want to know about the charges of widespread voter fraud? Call 800-642-1234. Again, the number is 800-642-1234, or tweet us at Central Time WPR. I want to go to one of our callers right now. We have Tim in Wabisa. Hi, Tim.
Hi. So I get all over Western Wisconsin and Eastern Minnesota, and I can think I could put a little bit of a view on the psychology behind it. People who live in a bubble, so I have mostly liberal friends. A lot of my people that I deal with have mostly conservative friends. So if they're told before an election that the only way we're going to lose this election is if the other side cheats, it matches with their narrative because they don't know any liberals. They only know conservatives. They only know Trump supporters. And of course, somebody had to have cheated if we lost, because there can't be that many liberals out there.
Tim, thank you for that call. And this comes back, if we were going to kind of accelerate this conversation, to a really big flashpoint in where widespread voter fraud became dangerous. And that was on January 6th, when President Trump's supporters went to the Capitol and caused a lot of destruction and violence in many ways. What was the connection between, what we're hearing, this kind of echo chamber, to what happened on January 6th?
Well, I think that, the idea that the election was stolen is a big idea that's made up of many strands and many sort of disparate claims, right? So what we know is a lot of people in the country, we know from polling that a lot of people, and particularly a lot of Republicans, believe that the election was not secure, that it was influenced by some kind of impropriety, whether that's hacking of machines or improprieties around the absentee ballots or what have you. And so that, we know that a lot of people believe that, and that Trump was, telling his supporters on January 6th that if they wanted a country, they had to fight for it and so on. He continued to insist that day that he had been wronged and that he had actually won. So I think that what we saw on January 6th is related to people's belief in the falsehood that Trump was the rightful winner of the election.
I want to go back to our callers right now. We have Paul in the Upper Peninsula. Hi, Paul.
Hi, and thanks for taking my call. Yeah, I think part of the problem is we all collectively, media included, need to really have very clear and succinct language that's fewer syllables and very, very succinct. Several times there's been a comment about debunked. A lot of people are not sure what that means. It's been proven false. it's very demonstrably been proven false. And when we talk about that in those kind of terms, or intentionally lied, intentionally misled to some of these people, I think it's much more clear to most of the public than using terms like debunked and some of these other ones that have a lot of vagarity and opacity on them.
Paul, thank you so much for that call. And I will say that I typically will use debunked because there you can always run afoul in some ways of how language is used. But that is an appreciated comment on my part. What do you think about what he had to say, Emma?
I appreciate what the caller said. And I, in our story, we went to lengths to explain exactly what some of these claims were that were being spread before the election and then after the election about machines being hacked and so on. And then explain why experts said that that was either not possible or there was no sign of that having happened. We also explained that in many jurisdictions, there were hand counts or recounts of paper ballots, which confirmed that the machines reported results accurately. So, as you may recall, in Georgia, there was a recount of the entire state of the hand ballots that showed that the machines in that state had counted accurately. The same thing happened in Antrim County, Michigan, where there has been this long-running claim that the machines there flipped a lot of votes from Trump to Biden. They too counted their ballots, paper ballots, and found that the machines reported accurate results. So I think, in our story, we tried to explain not just say that something had been debunked, but explain exactly what we know and how we know it.
We are talking to Emma Brown right now. She's an investigative reporter for The Washington Post, and we're taking a deep dive look into the origins of false claims, debunked claims of widespread voter fraud in the 2020 election and their origins about 6 years earlier. And so we are right now seeing pretty big audits in other states right now of their election results. We are now in July. The election was in November. Obviously so-called widespread voter fraud is not the only reason why this is happening, but how has it sort of dominated the conversation here and led to what we're seeing in places like Arizona?
Yeah, I think the audits have become the focal point for people who believe that the election was stolen through hacked machines. And I just mentioned Antrim County, Michigan. ASOG, the Russell Ramsland's firm, conducted what they said was a forensic audit of the machines there and claimed, as this is part of a court case, claimed to have found a 68% error rate in the Dominion machines there. That was totally false. It has been shown to be totally false. They misunderstood what they were looking at when they made that claim. Nevertheless, it was, it was tweeted by President Trump in mid-December and was sort of became a rallying cry. Their findings in Antrim County became a rallying cry. And so I think that these, what we see is people latching on to these audits or the idea of doing more audits as because they believe that they'll be able to find the evidence that has not yet been forthcoming, that there actually was fraud. And it's a sign, I think, that the suspicions around the election that were were part of the January 6th attack on the Capitol are not going away. They've not gone away. They're still with us and still driving politics and political decisions.
So if we are looking at some of the ripple effects of certainly what we saw in 2018 through 2020 and moving forward, we have midterms coming up in 2022. Could we start seeing more pushback from candidates in this vein moving forward? Obviously, it's still a little early, but do we have kind of political foresight here into what 2020 might look like?
Well, I think the audits have caused some, you know, observers to wonder whether this is the beginning of elections never ending and never being, concession speeches never happening and people continuing to fight the last election while preparing for the next. So I think that is a very much an open question, sort of how the aftermath of the 2020 election is going to feed into and change the way that elections and, you know, concessions of people recognizing publicly that they've lost, whether that's a tradition that we will start to lose.
And Emma, before we let you go, you're part of this investigative team. What will you be watching for next?
I am continuing, along with others at the Washington Post, continuing to watch the claims that are being made about the last election, but also looking for new claims made as we approach the midterms, as you said. I'm also really interested in what many experts have said are security concerns, new security concerns in areas where private actors, like in Arizona, are working hands on with these machines. They have said that the act of handing over custody of these machines to sort of non-government people, non-government officials, exposes them potentially to greater security risks than we've had in the past. So I think that election security moving forward is going to be something that continues to be a really important issue to cover carefully.
Emma, thank you so much for joining us to talk about this today.
Thank you so much for having me.
That was Washington Post investigative reporter Emma Brown explaining the origins of debunked claims of widespread voter fraud during the 2020 election and what it could mean for elections moving forward. Certainly, we have the 2022 midterms coming up. It's 2021, but they're right around the corner. On this week's Food Friday, we present a seemingly humble ingredient. Salt. Open up any pantry, look at any kitchen shelf, or even on the dining room table, and you are bound to find a variety or two. Salt is one of the building blocks of flavor and a crucial ingredient in many sweet and savory dishes. And we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. You can call in with your salt questions. You can also share some of your own salt tips. The number again is 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Of course, you can also post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Dan Souza joins us now. He is the editor-in-chief of Cooks Illustrated, and you can also catch him on America's Test Kitchen. And he also has a show on YouTube. Dan, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks for having me. It's good to be here.
So boil it down for us, no pun intended, but what exactly is salt?
So the salt that we have in our shakers, in our pantry that you're talking about there, it is mostly sodium chloride. And depending on the type of salt you have, there could be some trace other compounds in there as well. But for the most part, when we're talking about salt and the salt that we put in our food, it is sodium chloride, which is just, I don't know how nerdy we want to get, but just a molecule made up of a sodium and chloride ion. And it is a pretty magical thing in the kitchen.
This is a nerdy, safe space. So, of course, you can always take a deep dive into the chemical components of salt. Now, staying in that realm, if you look at salt, if you just pour it out, you probably don't pay attention to the shape, but salt has a pretty interesting structure. So before we take a look at it, why is structure important when it comes to salt?
It's a really, really good question. So, a lot of people think about salt and, maybe different flavors and different colors and stuff like that. But at the end of the day, what I think is most important is the structure of the salt that you're working with. And so in the kitchen, you're really looking at three kinds of salt, which are going to be table salt, which is everyone is super familiar with, kosher salt, and then sea salt. And if you look under a microscope at any one of these, depending on who's producing it, they look pretty different. The one thing that's really consistent is table salt is crystallized into tiny, perfect little cubes. It looks adorable under a microscope, just tons of little cubes piled together. And it's very, very fine. Kosher salt can be a lot of different shapes, but it's usually a lot larger. And the idea there, I mean, it was originally, you know, created for koshering meat. And so it sticks really nicely to meat, and it's easy to pick up with your fingers and season that way. So that larger shape and kind of jagged edges really help it do its job. And then sea salt is kind of a big category, and it can be everything from very fine, finely ground sea salt, which can kind of have an irregular but small shape, to really gorgeous, huge pyramid shapes that are created using kind of a very slow evaporation process. And those are fabulous as kind of finishing salts, can be super, super crunchy. But that texture really does impact it a lot, whether it's you're finishing with it and you want a lot of nice crunch to it, or it's really fine and it dissolves really easily. So it's great for seasoning dishes.
We are talking to Dan Souza right now. He's the editor in charge of Cooked Illustrated, and he's with us on this week's Food Friday to talk about salt. And we were just talking about the structure of salt. So you've got table salt, which is the small, cute little cube. And then you've got kosher salt, which can be different shapes, little less uniform compared to table salt. And that's why you can't, correct me if I'm wrong, swap them out one for one. Is that correct?
That's right. Yeah. So if you're measuring your salt by volume, you can get into some trouble if, you know, your recipe calls for table salt and you're using kosher salt or vice versa. So table salt across the board is really standardized. So it's always those tiny little cubes, and there can be, you know, it can be iodized or not, you know, as one variable, but they're pretty much the same. So if you're measuring table salt, you're fine across the board. There are primarily two kosher salts that are readily available to consumers, and they are Diamond Crystal and Morton. And even those measure differently by volume because they have a different density to them. So general rule of thumb is 3 teaspoons of Diamond. Then we're going to get really specific here. So 3 teaspoons or 1 tablespoon of Diamond Crystal kosher salt is equal to about 2 1/4 teaspoons of Morton kosher salt. And that's 1 1/2 teaspoons of table salt. So good little, you know, ratio to keep in mind if you're trying to, you know, switch back and forth depending on what the recipe's calling for.
And one thing that has stuck out to me, I'm relaying this anecdotally, but I've been seeing salt grinders become more and more common. I see it with, you know, pink Himalayan salt, I'm putting that in quotes, and sometimes with big coarse sea salt. Do salt grinders do anything?
Well, they definitely do grind big pieces of salt into smaller pieces of salt. I will say that they do something, but it's a funny kind of new thing on the market that does not work in the same way as, say, a pepper grinder, right? The reason that we love grinding black pepper and, you know, a lot of other spices kind of at the last minute is they contain tons of volatile aroma compounds, right? So when you grind pepper, you can smell it, and that dissipates really quickly when a spice is ground and sits around for a while. So, you know, that's an incredible benefit of grinding right before you need it. You have so much more flavor to it. Salt is not like that. So, you know, you can grind it way ahead of time and let it sit, and it'll last pretty much indefinitely. So, you know, I think if you enjoy grinding the salt on there and you're getting kind of a cool salt that you want to work with, that's great. I don't think it's necessary at all. I think, you know, for me, having, you know, a nice big flake finishing salt, like something like a Malden flake salt, is fabulous for seasoning things last minute, getting these punches of salinity. And then I really like having Diamond Crystal kosher salt on hand for, you know, so many other purposes. And then it's nice to have table salt. A lot of recipes call for it, especially in baking and things like that. So those three salts will get you pretty much, you know, all the way there. And you don't need a grinder to work with any of them.
I want to go to one of our callers right now. We have Gianni in Marquette County. Hi, Gianni.
Hello. I'm a bit of a gastronome, and I have a couple questions. What is the world's most highly esteemed salt? What is its price, and why might I like to try it in my kitchen?
Thanks for that call, Gianni. What do you say to that, Dan?
That's a great question. I'm not sure I'm an expert in the finest sea salts or salts out there, but I would say most of them are going to be sea salts, which are a lot more involved in terms of their their processing. So they take longer to make. They're usually a lot more hands-on. And I think classically, kind of traditionally, there's some French salts such as Fleur de Sel, which is very highly regarded. And, you know, it's created in these kind of shallow bodies of water where the concentration of the brine gets to a point where it's finally too concentrated. There's too much salt in there for what the water can hold. And then you get these kind of blooms of crystal on the surface, and they need to be raked off. So very hands-on. And, you know, it's pricey. I mean, the crazy thing about salt is it used to be very, very valuable, not even commodity, just very, very valuable. And it's so commoditized now that it's really cheap. We think of salt as really cheap. So I don't know the cost for Fleur de Sel, but it's really, you know, not an amount that you use. It's not an expensive thing to add to your kitchen. So, you know, it's kind of a fun thing to check out. But I'm sure I'm getting this wrong. I'm sure there's some really super high-end fancy salts out there that I'm not familiar with.
We are talking to Dan Souza right now. He's the editor-in-chief of Cook's Illustrated, and he's with us to talk about salt, all the different varieties, how to use it, and more. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. What questions do you have about salt? Do you have any tips of your own to share? We want to hear from you. Call 800-642-1234, or you can post on the Ideas Network Facebook page, and we'll continue this conversation coming up in just a minute on Central Time. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Jay Carlisle Larson. Right now, we pick up our conversation about salt on this week's Food Friday with Dan Souza, editor-in-chief of Cook's Illustrated. And you can join the conversation now at 800-642-1234. We want your salt questions, recommendations, mishaps, and everything in between. Call 800-642-1234. Now, Dan, before we went to the break, we talked about the different kinds of salt and why maybe sticking with table kosher and flaky sea salt might be your good salt trifecta. Now, when we use it for cooking, we don't just dump it in at the end, right? Or is there some best practices for proper seasoning while we're cooking?
Absolutely. Yeah. So, I mean, you know, most recipes will have kind of a season to taste step at the end, or most good recipes. I think that's a really key final step for folks. And that's because we all have different salt preferences. And I think it's really important that a recipe doesn't kind of get you all the way there until the end. So you have some ability to adjust. But most recipes will have, you know, salt going into the, let's say a stew or a pot early on and probably multiple times throughout the cooking. And the reason is, you know, things taste better with salt on them, right? And things are a lot more full. It really brings a lot of flavors to the top so that you can taste them. But it takes salt a long time to penetrate into things. So let's say you're cooking a beef stew and you forget to add the salt and you get all the way to the end and then you're like, oh, I've got to season this up. It's going to be really hard to make the meat and the carrots and the potatoes actually taste seasoned. You can season up the liquid really easily. The salt will dissolve in there, but the other stuff is going to taste pretty bland. But if you get salt in there from the very beginning, it's got time to slowly work its way into, you know, all the different cells, get all these through all these cell walls and actually get a little bit deeper. It's the same reason when we're making prime rib or working with roast chicken or you know, a large cut of protein, it's really helpful to salt it ahead of time. And then that can be, you know, it could be maybe an hour ahead of time or it can be days ahead. And that allows that salt to make its way in there and make each bite a little bit, you know, more seasoned.
I want to go to one of our callers right now. We have Jeff in Racine. Hi, Jeff. Jeff, are you there?
Yeah, I'm still here.
What did you want to ask?
I wanted to ask, when the recipe calls for salt to taste, what is it supposed to taste like? Are you supposed to taste the salt, or are you supposed to taste the flavorings of the meat, the vegetables, specifically what?
All right. Thank you so much for that call, Jeff. Dan, what does salt to taste mean?
That's an excellent question. So the real goal here is to make the final dish taste its best. And that usually does not mean taste like salt. You know, we've all had that experience when a little too much salt goes into something and it's really unpleasant and it's kind of all you can taste. So the goal with using salt is to bring out all the other flavors. And so what I like to do is that salt to taste that you'll see a lot of people get to the end of a recipe and then they're just, they add salt, right? Maybe they add salt and pepper without tasting it. I think it's really key. Taste it, taste a couple different components of it and figure out how it works for you. And if you're cooking for other people, you know, you got to think about them as well. If you've got someone who's really salt sensitive, you know, you might want to go a little lighter hand. But at that point, I like to, you know, taste it and season. I'm usually seasoning with kosher salt at that point, which is really easy to kind of, you know, figure out how much you're adding by hand and you get a lot more comfortable with it. And then stir it in. If it's a liquid environment, that sort of thing, you want to really stir it in, make sure it's even and dissolved before tasting again. You know, check that seasoning, see if you're there, and you can always add more. That's the big rule of salt. You can always add more. You can't take it out. So, you know, just go slow and get it to a point where you're happy. And then there's no shame with having salt, pepper on the table and let people adjust, because it is definitely a personal thing.
We are talking to Dan Souza right now, editor-in-chief of Cooks Illustrated, and he's with us today to talk about salt. And I'm going to go back to our callers now. We have Ethan in Grant County. Hi, Ethan.
Hi. I was just calling because I have a pretty simple question. So I have a lot of family who uses or doesn't use salt, I should say, when they're like baking, like cookies or any kind of sweet. And I know baking is more of a chemistry kind of idea, but I was hoping you could explain why you still want to put sweet in, like cookies and cakes and different things like that.
Ethan, thank you so much for that call. So why use salt in things like baking or things that are sweet?
It's an excellent question. And it can be really obvious when you try a baked good that doesn't have salt in it. And it, usually what your experience is, it just doesn't taste round and full in your mouth. It might have the sweetness but it just feels kind of lacking. And so, salt is interesting because it obviously tastes like salt, but, it has impact on, the other taste that we can perceive. So it actually, suppresses bitterness. I don't know if you've ever seen this, but sometimes people put a tiny pinch of salt into a cup of coffee, and it makes it less bitter. And it actually makes sweet things taste sweeter. So it kind of brings that to the fore. And it also just provides a balance to it. So if you have something that's sweet, 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 having a little bit of savory undertone to that can be really, really helpful. So I'm a big fan of salt in sweets and baked goods. And if you're ever looking at a recipe and you don't see it in there, I would definitely kind of question and, you know, think twice or think that you're probably going to want to add some to it to get the result you're looking for. Great question.
I want to go now to Don in Iron River. Hi, Don.
Hello. Say, what is pickling salt and why is it best to use it?
Thank you for that call, Don. And I'm going to guess that you want pickling salt for pickling. Is that correct, Don?
Correct.
All right. Dan, why pickling salt and what is its utility with, you know, canning or pickling or anything like that?
Yeah, that's another great question. So pickling salt is essentially an additive free salt. So it doesn't have anti-caking agents in it. It doesn't have iodine. And if you're using it in pickles, whether it's quick pickles or, you know, fermented, I mean, half sours or something like that, you won't get any off flavors and you won't get a cloudy brine to it. So that's really about it. And so, you know, if you can't find pickling salt, going for diamond crystal kosher salt, which, also is completely additive free, would totally work fine. And that's usually what we recommend when we're have a pickling recipe or something like that. But if you find pickling salt and you have it, absolutely use it. But it's just additive free, so you don't get any off flavors or discoloration of your brine.
We have a lot of callers who have questions about salt. I want to go to Stacy now in Milwaukee. Hi, Stacy.
Hi. Thank you so much. I would like some comments on a disagreement between a friend and myself. I consider salt to be a crystallized form of a wet ingredient because it's water soluble, and my friend considers it a dry ingredient, and we've discussed how to add it as such, and I would be curious about your guests' thoughts on that.
All right. Thank you so much, Stacy. So you've got to end this disagreement between Stacy and her friend. Is salt a wet ingredient or is it a dry ingredient?
Oh my God. I love this. This is a philosophical nature. So, So I'll say that, like, you know, all salt starts as a liquid ingredient. So in that way, I think you're right. Even if, you know, you're going to like salt mines to get it, those are like dried up oceans from, you know, eons ago. So, you know, I think you could call everything sea salt and be fine because it all originally came from there. And so it is, it's kind of a crystalline product of that. But at its like chemistry core, I would say that it's not, it is, you know, a dry ingredient. But in terms of adding it to recipes, I'm not even sure if that's the question. I think this is more just like a friend battle that I'm getting involved in. But in terms of adding it to recipes, you'll see it used, like, you know, I'm talking about baking recipes where you have kind of wet ingredients and dry ingredients and you're mixing them. You'll often see it in both, used in both ways. And I think that's fine. And it's not a super crucial thing that you separate out in one way or the other. And I think you get fine results where you want even mixing. It doesn't have to go in one place or the other.
So we don't have a lot of time left, but I have heard a story that you in your childhood attempted to make your own sea salt. Can you talk about what happened when you tried to make your own sea salt?
Yes, absolutely. It did not turn out very well. I was in Maine on vacation and I was getting into food and getting excited about it. So I got a few gallons from the ocean and I boiled it down until the pan was totally dry. And I scraped up this, you know, kind of white but grayish sort of powder. I was so excited. I tried it and it was one of the most bitter things I've put in my mouth. And you know, it took me some reading and some learning and kind of years later to understand what exactly I did wrong there. But, you know, ocean water obviously is rich in sodium chloride, but it also contains, magnesium and, some other minerals that can be really, bitter. And so what salt makers need to do is, when they're boiling down and kind of they're making their brine, some of the stuff will precipitate out and then they kind of rack the liquid off the top. There's also methods where you can kind of wash your salt after the fact, as crazy as it sounds, in a really concentrated salt solution and get rid of some of the other bitter compounds there. So most of the salt is, you know, 95 to 99% sodium chloride, and that's why it's just nice and salty and clean. If you add a lot of other minerals in there from the original ocean water, you find that it's pretty bitter and unpleasant.
So with that in mind, do you recommend that people maybe give it a shot if they happen to be near the ocean and have, you know, a few hours on their hands?
Yeah. So I have a recipe that I did for it that is, I think it's really fun. It definitely takes some time. It's more than a few hours in terms of the waiting time afterwards. But I think it's a great time. Yeah. The big key is like, make sure you're getting, you know, good water. You don't want to be like, you know, the harbor in a big city sort of thing. Like you want nice fresh water and strain it. And, but I think it's a really fun process. And if you make it, you can get some kind of cool big flakes and, you know, it can be a really fun gift to give to people too.
Well, Dan, thank you so much. That was Dan Souza, editor in chief of Cooks Illustrated. He joined us on this week's edition of Food Friday to talk about salt. You are listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network.